Welcome to the Bartlett Lecture Program. 20 years ago, in the gymnasium auditorium of this university, on this campus, the Constitution of the great state of Alaska was signed. In the words of one expert observer, quote, "The convention produced a document that was a rare blend of classic principles embodied and best in the U.S. Constitution, and of modern or innovative features altogether compatible with those principles, which made the Alaska Constitution more distinctly appropriate to its time and place than any other state constitution." Tonight, the topic that our distinguished speaker is going to address and later take questions from you is the U.S. Constitution today. Our speaker brought a rare blend of classic principles and folk wisdom appropriate to the time and place when, as chairman of the Senate Select Committee on Presidential Campaign Activities, he directed the famous Watergate hearings. His eyebrows signaled his concern. His questions penetrated the issues. His stories gave texture, enlightenment, and leaven as he performed with dedication and commitment. He looks like a senator, handsome, distinguished, white hair, portly, a banker plump. He talks like a senator, articulate, full-voiced, engaging. It is my privilege to present to this audience a student, a lifelong student of the United States Constitution, the Honorable Sam J. Irvin.
Friends, it's a great privilege to be in the state of Alaska. The potential of Alaska is unlimited, and it's particularly a great privilege to be here and to participate in the Bob Bartlett Lecture Series. I had the privilege of serving in the Congress with Bob, and I think that he was one of the finest human beings I've ever been privileged to know. He loved Alaska. But he also loved every other portion of the United States. He was a truly great American. And he enjoyed in the highest degree both the affection and the admiration of those who had the privilege of working with him. I have retired from the Senate and thus escaped the confusion of Washington. I frequently tell a story which explains why there's so much confusion in Washington. About the beginning of this century, two of the leading citizens of my hometown of Morganton in the foothills of the Blue Ridge Mountains in North Carolina were Manny McDowell, the county sheriff, and Bob Hennessy. Manny McDowell was the most cross-eyed man the good Lord ever created, with the exception of his friend Bob Hennessy, who was equally as cross-eyed. They were walking along the street in opposite directions one day and bumped into each other. And Manny McDowell said, "Bob Hennessy, why in the devil don't you look where you're going?" And Bob Hennessy said, "Manny, it wouldn't do a damn bit of good because you don't go where you're looking." It is in Washington. So many people in high places don't look where they're going, and so many don't go where they're looking, and that accounts for the confusion. Now, everything in Washington is not necessarily in a state of confusion. Sometimes some things that happen that make you forget about the confusion. And I'll tell you two stories, one about what a Democrat said about a Republican and another about what a Republican said about a Democrat, and thus keep the meeting on a nonpartisan or bipartisan plane. We had a Republican congressman from Wisconsin named Frank Keefe. And Frank had a rather caustic tongue. And Frank didn't like any Democrats, and particularly didn't like a young Democrat who had just been elected to Congress from Wisconsin. Well, in those days, they had a Un-American Activities Committee of the House was engaged in investigating communism. And they had a congressman from New York, Vito Marcantonio, who was reputed to be a communist. And they had a resolution up one day to give $50,000 additional appropriation to the House Un-American Activities Committee to further investigate communism. And this young congressman from Wisconsin, whom Frank Keefe didn't like, got up and made a very vigorous speech against the resolution to appropriate this money. Then somebody called for a roll call, and the call was sustained, and it became apparent to this young congressman that if he voted like he spoke, he was likely to be recorded on the roll call as voting with Vito Marcantonio, the communist, against all the other members of the House. So having made this very vigorous speech against the resolution, when they called his name on the roll call, he voted for the resolution. And after the roll call was completed, Frank Keefe arose and said, "Mr. Speaker, in my old age," said, "I'm getting just a little bit deaf." Now, Alvin Barker said that whenever a senator or congressman was fixing to stick a stiletto in another one's back and twist it, he always paid him high compliments. So Frank Keefe said, "Mr. Speaker, I couldn't hear how my able and distinguished and illustrious colleague from Wisconsin, Mr. B. So-and-so, voted on this resolution." Whereupon Frank Keefe was informed by the speaker, Sam Rayburn. Sam Rayburn was speaking in a somewhat irritated tone of voice. He said, "It's recorded as having voted in favor of the resolution." Whereupon Frank Keefe said, "Well, Mr. Speaker, it is evident that the speech, which my distinguished and eminent and illustrious colleague made in opposition to this resolution, was no more convincing to himself than it was to the intelligent members of this House." Now, I've told you about what the Republicans said about the Democrat. I'll now tell you about what the Democrats said about the Republican. When I got to Washington and served in the House in 1946, my next door neighbor was Congressman Charlotte La Follette from Evansville, Indiana. He was no kin, so far as I know, to the La Follettes of Wisconsin. I got to know Charlie fairly well, and I found out very soon there were two classes of people he didn't like. The first were Southern Democrats, and the other were Orthodox Republicans. Charlie was the most liberal person in the modern acceptation of that much abused term that I've ever known to be in the Republican Party. Charlie decided he'd run for the Senate in Indiana, where they nominated in a convention. And he went out to Indiana and made a speech throughout Indiana abusing the Republican bosses who were going to dominate the convention at whose hands he was seeking the Republican nomination for the United States Senate. When the convention met, the inevitable happened and Charlie was soundly defeated. He then issued a statement to the press to the effect that he had decided that the Republican Party was not the vehicle by which progressive legislation could be obtained, and therefore he was going to sever his connection with the Republican Party on the expiration of his term in Congress. He said, however, I don't want anybody to think I'm going to join the Democrats, because I couldn't possibly be a Democrat until the Democratic Party gets rid of its Southern appendages, referring to Southern Democrats like me. Well, Charlie was back on the House floor the next morning. We had a congressman from Mississippi, John Rankin, who had a very fine sense of humor and sometimes caustic tongue. And John Rankin arose the next morning and read this statement to the House, in which Congressman LaFotta had stated he was going to leave the Republicans but not join the Democrats. And John Rankin said, this statement reminds me of a friend of mine down in Mississippi who loves to browse around in old cemeteries and read the epitaphs on the gravestones. He said, my friend always carries a pocket full of chalk when he goes into an old cemetery, so if the lettering on the gravestone is indistinct, he can rub the chalk over the face of the stone and bring out the lettering so he can read the epitaph. He said, on one occasion, my friend was in this old cemetery down in Mississippi and read this epitaph. Pause thou, stranger, passing by. As you are now, so once was I. As I am now, you soon will be. Prepare for death and follow me. And John Rankin said, Mr. Speaker, when my friend read that epitaph, he felt like I did after I read Congressman LaFotta's statement about how he was going to leave the Republicans but not join the Democrats. So my friend reached in his pocket and brought out a piece of chalk and wrote these words under the epitaph. To follow you, I'll not consent until I find which way you went. So much for the humorous things. We have the greatest country on earth. And the greatest possession of our country is not this vast domain, which constitutes the territorial status of the United States, and which makes a part of the United States all of the North American continent except Canada and Mexico. It's not our great industrial empire. Our greatest possession is not our army and our navy. Our greatest possession as Americans is our Constitution. Some 11 years before the Constitution was drafted, and 13 years before it or 12 years before it became effective, the Continental Congress adopted the Declaration of Independence. About the middle of June 1776, Richard Henry Lee of Virginia had introduced a resolution declaring that the 13 original states or colonies were free and independent. And the Continental Congress established a committee of 5 members, consisting of Benjamin Franklin, Roger Sherman, John Adams, Robert Livingston, and Thomas Jefferson, to write a document explaining in the event the Lee resolution was adopted, why the original colonies or states had severed their political bands to England. And so on the second day of July 1776, the Richard Henry Lee resolution was adopted, proclaiming America to be free and independent. And 2 days later, the committee reported to the Continental Congress, and the Continental Congress made
public the Declaration of Independence, which had been written largely by Thomas Jefferson and which had been reported with slight changes by the Committee of Five to the Continental Congress. This Declaration of Independence is America's most eloquent state paper. It sets forth in detail why the 13 original states were separating themselves from the mother country, England, and what they had done in an effort to bring about a reconciliation with England. The Declaration of Independence has very little political philosophy in it, but it does have this. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. To secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. This portion of the Declaration of Independence was, in effect, a pledge which the Continental Congress made to the American people that the Constitution which should be adopted for the government of America should secure to all Americans the right to pursue happiness. This is a very entrancing phrase. What does it mean? The meaning of the pursuit of happiness is very simple. Every man, and I always explain for fear of offending somebody who's inherited the woman's lib, that I use the word man in the generic sense, as doing what the men like to do, that is embracing the women. And I use the term to include both men and women. Every man has certain absolute needs. He has certain longings, certain ambitions, and certain aspirations. As a physical being, man needs food and shelter and clothing and many material things. As a human being, he longs for a measure of dignity and respect. As a political being, man longs to have a voice in the government which is to rule over him. And as an intellectual being, he desires to be permitted to use his brain freely, subject to no external restraint. And man is innately a religious being, and he wants to have the privilege of bowing his own knees to his own God in his own way. And the effort or the quest for the satisfaction of these needs and ambitions and longings and aspirations is the pursuit of happiness. Now, the men who wrote our Constitution, they redeemed the pledge which the members of the Continental Congress had made to them when they adopted the Declaration of Independence. And they set forth in the Constitution, in varying phraseology, five great freedoms to enable all Americans to pursue happiness. They were willing to recognize an economic truth which a lot of us would like to forget, and that is that earth yields nothing whatever to man except the products of his own labor. They also recognize certain great psychological truths in respect to labor. They recognize that the great sculptor Michelangelo applied one of these great psychological truths to his own life when he said, "It is only well with me when I have a chisel in my hand." They also knew that what we call Adam's curse is an unchanging and unchangeable law of life. In the sweat of thy face shalt thou eat bread till thou return unto the ground. And so they adopted a constitution whose phrase that government shall not deny any person life, liberty, or property except by due process of law. In that phrase, liberty, they gave to every American the right to pursue the occupation of his choice without the consent of government. They also recognized that free men cannot be induced to produce goods or services of value unless they have some incentive for so doing. And the incentive which they secured to Americans to produce goods and services of value was a constitutional guarantee that they would have the right to retain a fair share of the fruits of their labor for themselves, their families, and the causes they hold dear. And this is what we call the free enterprise system, with this incentive. And this free enterprise system has worked so well that it has made America the greatest economic force and the greatest economic power the earth has ever known. And so we might say that the first of the five great freedoms the Constitution secures to us to enable us to pursue happiness is economic freedom. They recognize, moreover, that man does not live by bread alone, that man has certain human desires for dignity and respect. And so they added a second great freedom to enable Americans to pursue happiness. And that great freedom might be called, it's a bundle of freedoms, and it might be called, for shortness of expression, individual freedom. They decreed in the Constitution that no American should be subject to unreasonable personal restraints and imprisonment. And they secured to us a great writ of habeas corpus in the Constitution in order that any American might have a right to contest before a judicial tribunal the legality of any physical restraint imposed upon him. They also gave to every American the right to travel anywhere throughout the borders of our land. And as a result of this right, I guess the American people are the most mobile people on earth. And as the years go by, you're going to appreciate in Alaska the meaning of this right, because you're going to find that more and more Americans, as the years go by, visit this portion of the earth, which from everything I've seen and everything I read, contains more beauty than any other area on Earth's surface. Then in addition to that, they gave a man the right to marry, to establish a home, to rear children. And they gave him, as a part of his bundle of personal freedoms, the right to take any course of action which will help him to successfully pursue happiness as long as he does not interfere with the pursuit of happiness on the part of others. So the first two rights they gave us to pursue happiness were economic freedom and personal freedom. The men who wrote our Constitution believed, like those who adopted the Declaration of Independence, that all of the just powers of government are derived from the consent of the governed. And so the Constitution they framed gave every American the right to have a voice in the government which rules over him. Under the First Amendment, every American has a right peacefully to assemble with others of like mind and to petition government for redress of grievances, real or imagined, if he possesses the qualifications prescribed in the Constitution. He has the right to vote, and he has the right to hold office. And the men who drew our Constitution realized some great truths about government and men. I would commend to every American the frequent reading of George Washington's farewell address to the American people. And in that great address, he states a very unhappy truth, and that truth is that men who occupy governmental offices have a love of power and a proneness to abuse it. And George Washington tells us in the farewell address, in effect, that they drew the Constitution because they recognized that it was necessary to restrain the insatiable thirst of public officials for more power. And he describes in there why they separated the powers of government by giving to Congress the power to make laws and to conduct investigations of the state of the government, and imposed upon the President the duty of enforcing the laws passed by Congress, and gave to the courts the power to interpret laws. He said they put these three, divided these great powers of government among these three great departments so that each department would have some motive for resisting encroachments upon its domain by the other great departments of government. And if there are any Americans of any generation that ought to appreciate the separation of the powers of government made by our Constitution is Americans of your and my generation, because we have just gone through a great tragedy known as Watergate. And we saw in that great tragedy that when one of the departments of government, namely the presidency, failed to perform its constitutional duty, that two of the other departments of government, the Congress and the courts, remain faithful to their constitutional trust, and as a result, our nation was able to pass without bloodshed or turmoil or strife through a great crisis. And we witnessed the transition of power from one president to another without any serious disturbance. And I don't believe that that could happen in any nation on the face of the earth without bloodshed or trouble, except in a constitutional republic like ours, where the powers of government are divided among different departments. If all of the powers of government had been concentrated in one department, and that department had failed us, the entire government would have collapsed. And that shows the wisdom of the Founding Fathers in dividing the powers of government between the states on the local level and the national government on the national level and among the three branches of the national government. They divided the powers of government in this fashion because they realized the great truth that had been proclaimed by an English philosopher, Thomas Hobbes. He said that freedom is political power divided in small fragments. They also recognized another great truth about government, which was subsequently proclaimed by Daniel Webster in a very eloquent expression. Daniel Webster said, "Whatever government is not a government of laws is a despotism, let it be called what it may." The meaning of a government of laws is very simple. The men who drew our Constitution were determined that we would have a government of laws rather than a government of men. A government of laws is a government where the rights and responsibilities of the people and the powers and the limitations upon the powers of public officials are defined by certain and constant and uniform laws rather than by the inconstant, uncertain, and arbitrary wills of men who occupy public office. And one of the great things that grew out of Watergate was a decision of the Supreme Court of the United States to the effect that the President of the United States is subject to the laws just like all the rest of the people. Something they should not have been needed to be decided again, because that had been decided before in times past.